Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, we'll talk about the best organic gardening methods on How Homeopathy Helps to Grow Great Gardens, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck and international expert agro-homeopath Kavi Raj. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hello, this is Debbie Bruck of Homeopathy World Community. And we are going to have a show today, but our co-host is having a great deal of difficulty signing in. So we're going to have to figure out how to accommodate this problem. So I will just give you a little bit of a regular introduction today. I am Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community. And if Kavi Raj is not able to actually call in, I will chat with him and see if I can just relay his messages to you. Also, Kavi Raj is the international best-selling author of Homeopathy for Farm and Garden, which has been translated into 7 languages. And it's possible that Dr. Robert Bruck, North Carolina State University professor of environmental science and technology and plant pathologist, might call in also. So we're going to see if we can work out the bugs here and see what's going on, why he, Kavi Raj, is unable to call in today. I am going to try and contact some help, and I'm going to also let you know that, give a little kind of review of where we have been. So, okay, so here we go. And for all those of you who are hearing me hem and haw on the radio today, it's because everything is kind of hitting the fan at once. We've got so much news going on that I wanted to inform everyone that tomorrow we're going to have a regular Vaccination in Your Right show with legal expert Alan Phillips. And then we're going to have a special second hour on the Blog Talk Radio show with Manfred Mueller, who is the president of the North American Society of Homeopaths. And he's going to guide us through the issue of toxicity and how homeopathy can help in these cases. And I think he's going to be specifically speaking about mercury toxicity, which is really throughout our society. It comes in the form of amalgams, in vaccinations and other areas of our life. And he's going to be talking about implementing a safe and effective plan for detoxification. There are also many other things happening. We've been requested to announce that the Millions Against Monsanto webinar will be tomorrow, February 24th, 2011, at 7 p.m. And I can provide you with a link, or you can just go to the Millions Against Monsanto website to find out about this free webinar, Why We Need a Truth in Labeling Campaign. And I'm going to still try and get some help in the getting our person to get us on the line with Kavi Raj today. So you might hear me clicking away and see if they can do anything in the background, because I do the show by myself every single week, 4 times a week now. I do the show by myself without a manager, and it means that you have to kind of multitask. So let's go ahead with the show. I think I'm hearing somebody's calling me, and you're going to be on the line with me, I guess, to figure out what's going on here. Well, I'll just do the show without any help today. Be on my own. It's called Independent Living. Well, we have been talking about cold frames and starting your garden and how to get your plants to grow and putting your seeds into a dilution of silica to jumpstart your seeds and give them some support in their coming out into the world by giving them a hard shell to burst forth through the ground with that extra dose of silica. And then Kaviraj told us about oniscus, another remedy. And you'll have to listen to last week's show to find out about that. It's to get rid of the pill bugs that are in our garden. They're like little armadillos. And that is the remedy that's used for that. And then we started to talk about companion planting. Plus, to inhibit germination, we use Juglans nigra, black walnut. So these are all things that we do using homeopathy in our garden. And today we're going to continue to talk about getting those cold frames started and also using the homeopathy to get your plants growing. So I'm going to just chat with Kaviraj because we are live today. Okay, so we're going to talk about imagining that you're going to start your garden with fresh lettuce and spinach, radishes and green onions and other vegetables that you have been growing in your cold frame. And they are very easy to construct and take very little care. You want to be sure that it has a hinge so that it can open up when the weather gets too warm and release some of that heat that is locked in there. And we're not going to be talking really about creating a hotbed because we've already started the spring weather. But if you're doing your cold frame in the wintertime, you can actually heat the soil and keep your crops growing throughout the winter. But in this case, you don't have to be a real fancy carpenter in order to create your cold frame. You can just get some simple materials using, let's say, an old window for your top and then some pieces of wood. Or we talked about using brick along the side, but we should not be using cinder blocks because of the chemicals that are in there. Then we talk about where you place your cold frame. You want your cold frame to be facing south for the maximum amount of sunlight exposure. And it should have at least 10% of an angle. I see that Kaviraj is still not able to call in, but that's okay. We can just go ahead with the program. And so we're going to talk about having that cold frame facing a southern exposure to get the most amount of sun. And if you don't have that southern exposure on your property, the second choice would be a western exposure. And the third choice, if you don't have either of those two, would be eastern. And that's like where the sun comes up in the morning, that east-facing window. You love to have it in your kitchen for getting that light into your life in the morning. So Kaviraj explains to us that we have nurse cropping tall or dense canopied plants that may protect more vulnerable species. So you're planning out your garden and you want to make sure that your plants are protected from the weather, from harsh weather. And when it's like too sunny, so you want to have them shaded or by providing a windbreaker of plants. And also you want to nurse your crops. You want to nurse your crops such as oats have been long used to help establish alfalfa and other forages by supplanting the more competitive weeds that would otherwise grow in their place in many instances. Nurse cropping is simply another form of physical spatial interaction. And I think it's kind of somewhat like companion planting, but one plant is helping the other plant in terms of its space, the weather conditions, reaching the sunlight. And I'm just going to make a little note here about that alfalfa. We're going to try and do our best in our gardens to find some organic alfalfa seeds and maybe store them, because right now we know that the government in the United States has officially approved GMO alfalfa, which we're not at all thrilled about, and get on those petitions and change what's been the damage that has already been made into policy, because we know that the alfalfa is fed to animals, which it's their feed, and then we're going to eat the animals. Not a good idea. We've also got information about beneficial habits and habitats, rather. Beneficial habitats is sometimes called refugia and are another type of companion plant interaction that has drawn considerable attention in recent years. The benefits, this is completely new information to me. I'm curious to know how many other people have heard of this. And I'm going to spell it out for those people who are on the chat line today. Refugia, it's R-E-F-U-G-I-A. So if you're doing a web search, you can look it up and learn a little bit more about it. The benefit is derived when companion plants provide a desirable environment for beneficial insects and other arthropods, especially those predatory and parasitic species, which help to keep pest populations in check. So here we're looking at natural means of reducing the pest population through this beneficial... Oh, there's no sound? Nobody's hearing any sound today? Please let me know if you have any sound. It's possible that Kaviraj is just, his computer's not hooked up at all today, because if he can't hear me, oh, but he's on the chat. Hey, Kavi, you can talk right here on the chat, too. So we're going to just be continuing on, because he's having a problem to hear me and to call in today. Okay, Victor says we're getting good sound, so we're doing a sound check. Tapping my mic here, which I don't even have. So the predators that we know are include ladybird beetles, lacewings, hoverflies, mantids, robber flies. I'm going to suggest Kavi close out and shut down and reopen, because he's not with us at all. So if he can't hear me, he can't participate too well. So we're going to just keep going. Predators include ladybug beetles, lacewings, hoverflies, mantids, robber flies, and non-insects, such as spiders and predatory mites. They have eight legs, and I guess those are the arthropods. Parasites include a wide range of fly and wasp species, including tachinid flies, Entrichogramma, and ichneumonid wasps. And I have no idea whether I have pronounced those properly. You know, you're talking in a different language when you get into those scientific nomenclatures. So agroecologists believe that by developing systems to include habitats that draw and sustain beneficial insects, the twin objectives of reducing both pest damage and pesticide use can be attained. And you can think of this as creating your own little ecosystem. Think of it as like an aquarium. It's it's only larger than the aquarium, because you think of the aquarium, it's in a bowl or in a encased, it's a closed ecological system that you have to have the right amount of oxygen, a clean water that's not filled up. You need to have your filter in there, whether you've got your filter type fish and your charcoal filter and your all that kind of filter and running water, you need a stream. So if you're talking about the ecosystem of a lake, you know, you have an inlet and an outlet. You need to have the movement, the flow, the clean cleansing elements and the filtering process. And we want to have the insects and the animals that come into each of these little ecosystems being beneficial to each other, so that there is a balance and there's not an overgrowth of one thing or another. So that's why he's teaching us about how to keep everything in check using natural means rather than inundating with some sorts of pesticides, chemical fertilizers, and things that can cause an imbalance, actually, of what is in our personal ecosystem, which we are connected to the whole world, to the whole earth, and therefore we are part of the larger ecosystem. So we're going to talk a little bit more about our planting guide and perhaps go back to more about the cold frame later. The alfalfa, there is the perennial that roots deeply. And that's why he suggests using alfalfa. It fixes the soil with the nitrogen. It accumulates iron, magnesium, phosphorus, and potassium. And it withstands droughts or droughts, whichever part of the country you're from, with its long taproot and can improve just about any soil. So you know when a type of a plant has a deep, straight taproot that goes straight down into the soil, it's going to be able to survive whether there is a little bit of rainfall, or if there's a lot, then probably the taproot won't go down quite so deep into the earth. And I could tell you a side story. I was walking around my block the other day, and one of the people who have a magnificent garden was out there digging away. He had a large tree that had been in the ground maybe 10 years, and it was crowded in the space where it was. Most of his garden is crowded because he's got so much in there. And he wanted to give room for a smaller Japanese maple tree. Well, he was digging away, and I know that he's going to have to go quite a few feet down because that tree had a taproot, and there was no taking it out of the ground and keeping it to survive unless you go in really deep with that root ball. And that was my little side story for today. I did also tell him about today's show. So if anybody's out there and you love the show, tell your friends, because we do learn a lot here. And so these alfalfa plants he's suggesting is one of the types of plants that does have the long taproot. And it also has the ability to break up hard clay soil and can even send its roots through rocks. Wow! Now that is a tenacious plant. Alfalfa is practically pest and disease free. Now, why would we GMO this magnificent plant that is so tasty in our garden salads and so full of nutrition, and here we are messing it up? That's kind of upsetting. But I'm learning so much about alfalfa. We're going to have to do a show on how you sprout it in your own home, or we could just put up a video for that. It needs only natural rainfall to survive. And it's interesting because there are folks who live in areas of the country like myself where the earth has a large portion of clay. And so alfalfa would be really, really good. And I'm wondering about those people who live in areas of the country that have sandy soil. Would the alfalfa also work in that type of landscape? because I was reading somewhere that people have to actually add clay to their soil if they're living in beachfront area. So we'll get to that when Kaviraj is back on the line. We have also amaranth, which is another tasty grain, a tropical annual that needs hot conditions to flourish. Good with sweet corn, its leaves provide shade, giving the corn a rich, moist root run. And it is a host to predatory ground beetles, and it eats the young leaves, and we eat the young leaves in our salad of the amaranth plant. And I want to direct your attention to an article. I don't have the link right on with me right now, but Victor, who is with us most every radio show, spoke about plants and eating plants that are from your local area, and that certain plants are good for different types of people in different cultures, because whether you're living in a tropical zone or moderate zone or a northern zone, you're going to want to have different types of plants in your garden that's going to be beneficial to you dealing with the seasons and the weather. And I want to thank Victor for that information. Maybe he can find the article and put it into the chat so we've got the link to his notes. I think it was one of his personal blogs. I featured it just the other day. Now we're moving on to anise. This really has a very recognizable flavor. It's just like licorice, and it's an herb that we use. I throw it into some soup a lot of times or into the garden. Oh, we've got somebody calling in. Hey.
Hello.
Dr. Bob, hello. I didn't realize you were calling in. I was so busy concentrating on the plants in our garden and how they create an ecological system if we know how everything balances out. And Kaviraj has been sending me some notes about the specific plants in his plant guide.
Uh-huh.
And maybe you have some comments about
agriculture.
Maybe you have some comments about this method that we're talking about. It's kind of like biodynamic gardening, I would say.
Well, I just finished giving a lecture to 200 students on organic agriculture 5 minutes ago. And one of the, can you hear me okay?
Could you speak up a little bit louder or turn up your volume?
Okay. How's this?
Well, just speak right into your mic.
Okay. Well, I'm talking into the phone right now.
Okay.
Basically, I just finished a lecture on organic agriculture, and we were talking about all the different methods that we can use in order to grow plants without GMO organisms, without pesticides, and without chemical fertilizer. And one of the ways is to actually make sure that you are companion planting is one of the terms, because what you're doing is allowing one plant to use the various elements of its biochemistry to protect other plants, both in the root and the shoot, due to the natural biochemicals that it gives off. So the fact is that we have learned a lot about companion planting, putting them together, and being able to avoid the use of chemicals in agriculture.
Right, and this is one of the fundamental things that Kaviraj teaches us. We talked about it last time about companion planting and how they the two plants have mutually beneficial relationships, and they can grow. So we're going to continue on with the list of wonderful plants in his plant guide, and how they help each other, how these plants can help each other in the garden. So the anise plant we were just mentioning is a good host for predatory wasps. So you want to bring those wasps in, which will prey on your aphids, and is also said to repel aphids. That's interesting. So it does both attract and repel. and it deters pests from the brassicas by camouflaging their odor. So it has quite a bit of methods to work with our garden. I've never planted anise, or maybe I just haven't been successful at planting it, and it would be good to give it a go this year. I think the plant that I typically do is fennel, and it also has a licorice type of scent. And I also am putting it into our soups and our salads, and it's a lovely, lovely plant. Maybe Kaviraj could tell us a little bit about fennel also. But the anise itself improves the vigor of any plants that's growing near it. It's used in ointments to protect against bug stings and bites, and it's good to plant with coriander. So there you have your companion planting, anise and coriander. It sounds like
a
great...
Let me ask a question about that. Okay, I see in my listing that there is a homeopathic remedy that's considered to be a biodynamic remedy called anise pyrite. Okay, are you familiar with that?
I would have to look it up.
All right.
What is it? How do you spell it?
Well, just anise, A-N-I-S-E, pyrite, P-Y-R-I-T-E. Maybe
okay.
Someone knows about that and can say something. For humans, it is here talked about for bronchial asthma, immune systems, larynx, throat.
Yeah,
and
it is used for the same. It's used for the same things. I don't really know what it's called. Anisum.
A N I S U M.
Anisum, and it's used for bronchitis.
Right.
Yes. Or. Anise pyrite, that's correct. A-N-I-S-E P-Y-R-I-T-E. And
correct.
It is in the pharmacy. A number of pharmacies do have that particular remedy used for bronchitis.
But I'm wondering how that might be used in agriculture.
That's a good question. I don't know if it's the same remedy is the same thing as the anise plant. What is the formal scientific name of anise? We would have to look that up.
Yeah.
And that's why the internet is so great. I'll let somebody look that up while we continue on with the notes. We've got...
Yeah, well,
you want to look it up?
Yeah, well, it is. Anise is Pimpinella anisum.
So
Pimpinella
is it the same
anisum,
thing as anise pyrite? I don't know.
Okay.
It's also used for sore throats and laryngitis.
Right,
and they make it into like lozenges and things like that.
Right. So the APACE.
Okay. So what is that? APACE?
APACE. That is the family that it's in from the Eastern Mediterranean and Southeast Asia.
Okay.
Resembles licorice, fennel, and tarragon.
Okay, so that must be it then for sure.
Uh-huh.
Because if it's got that same flavoring, then that's definitely got to be it. And so now, was there a specific question about that?
Well, the question I was asking is again, you were talking about biodynamic agriculture. And anise is listed as one of these things there. I'm just sort of wondering how that works, if anybody had any information on that.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And, you know, Kaviraj has investigated and done so much research with a great number of plants. But I think companion planting is one of his top priorities. And
right.
I don't know whether he has specifically used it as a on a homeopathic potency level, because if it's used for bronchitis and stuff like that, I don't
right.
know whether that would be something we would be needing specifically for the plants.
Right, that's what I was asking.
Right, it's a good human homeopathic remedy, but I don't know how it would work for plants. The next plant that he has in his guide, Kaviraj says on the chat that it can be used and it does work, but what symptoms would it be working for if it's a lung So maybe if the plant is not getting enough oxygen or if it's congested in some way, you'll have to elaborate on that. In the meantime, we have the asparagus plant, which we plant with tomatoes, parsley, basil, and we sprinkle parsley leaves onto the asparagus while it is growing. This is truly, truly fascinating, the different methods that we use to integrate the plants and help them along. It is used, Kaviraj, is that the anise used as a pest repellent or is it the asparagus? Which one? Okay. Oh, the anise, he says, is used as the predatory wasps as a host for them, to give them a home. So therefore, I guess it's used mainly as a pest repellent when you're talking about the anise pyrite or the anisum in potency. Okay. I don't want to confuse the listeners. So let's move on then to the asparagus now. And this is really, really good with companion planting. And we know that asparagus grows the best by the beach areas in the sandy soil. It needs a lot of room for the roots to spread out and grow. And it's unusual if anybody has ever planted asparagus. You have to get and gather the fruit right away when it's first coming out of the ground, because if you go back a day later, it could already have sprouted up and gone to seed or gone to flower. So you have to keep a good eye on your asparagus plant. And they're so beautiful, you can even cut them and bring them in a vase, very much like a fern. They have such a feathery type of a leaf arrangement. Is there anything else that we need to learn about the asparagus besides, I personally feel it's one of the first spring plants that has a very, I don't know, how do you call the flavor? I think it tastes a lot like fresh peas, but it's such a delicious flavor all on its own, just raw, that you really don't have to cook them.
Well, here it says on the companion plant guide, it says that growing asparagus is helped by the aster family, dill, coriander, tomato, parsley, basil, comfrey, and marigolds.
Okay, so you
so exceed, obviously you it has a lot of companion plants, probably more so than most.
And I had no idea about that. And so you really expanded out besides tomato, parsley, and basil. There were a lot of other ones like comfrey.
Comfrey, marigolds.
Marigolds.
Parsley, tomato.
Marigolds.
Well, marigolds, it specifically says here, when planted with asparagus, will deter beetle infestation.
Very good. And we know that we usually plant tomatoes and marigolds together, too.
Right.
Marigolds
That's right.
Like a general companion plant, I would think. Maybe Kaviraj can elaborate on the marigold, which we don't consider. He's been giving us mostly herbs and vegetables, but the marigold is a flowering plant that we know it's really, really helpful if you've got a totally ecological system and you've got chickens in your garden. They also thrive when they get the marigold plant to make the yolks of their eggs very richly orange.
Right. And well, it induces them to produce vitamin A and D in their yolks. Yeah.
Yeah. So marigold, everybody wants to have that in their garden. We're going to move on to the basil plant, which is, we just mentioned. Okay. Kaviraj says the marigold is also good, to combat the nematodes. And so it's just an all-around wonderful, wonderful plant, and it's lovely to look at and comes in a variety of colors. Then we've got the basil plant, which goes really well with tomatoes to improve growth and flavor, and pepper, marigold. So he's added the marigold there, and the basil can be helpful in repelling thrips, those little white insects. And it is said to repel flies and mosquitoes, but it's not a good, you don't want to plant your basil next to the rue, R-U-E plant, because it's incompatible with that. So take your rue and put it in a pot, put it on a side a little bit of further away from your basil and your tomatoes. So that's Ruta. That's Ruta-Roo, I believe. Is that Ruta graveolens, Kavi,
yes.
When you talk about rue? And that one is homeopathically good for tennis elbow, injury to your joints and your tendons. So we've got quite a few vegetables and herbs that we've gone through here. And basil, as we know, even tastes delicious with your tomato plants. With a little olive oil and salt and pepper, you got it made. Okay, so we've got the link for biodynamics.com/biodynamics from Victor. So he teaches us a little bit about biodynamic gardening. And we're going to move to bay leaf. This is another wonderful herb that's used in stews and soups. Whether you put and delicious with fish. So whether you put the entire leaf in with your cooking or you crumble it up into smaller amounts, I have a feeling that when you're using fresh herbs like this, you use less than when you're using the dried herbs. So the fresh leaf bay leaf is in each storage container of beans and grains will deter weevils and moths. Fascinating what we can do with the bay leaf. It's kind of reminds
me. I have a question.
Yes.
Okay, I'm reading. I have a wonderful link right here called "What Companion Plants Do to Deter Pests." Okay, and it has a list of like 100 different plants, including bay leaf is the first one here under B, and it mentioned the fact that what you just said repels weevils, moths, beetles, ladybugs, etc.
Yes.
What I want to know, I mean, obviously all of these things on this list have certain biochemical properties that are used as a repellent, which can be used in companion planting, as you just said, very effectively. What I'm wondering about is, can any of these things be used in a homeopathic sense by potentizing the actual raw plant? Okay, the way traditional Hahnemann potentizing and using it as a systemic spray on a plant, is that going to have a similar effect?
Kaviraj would be the one to ask. And I'm sure that if you get his book, Farm and Garden, it will have a listing of all of these plants and how they're used in potency. Because
okay.
For some of the really major plants dealing with their application, I'm sure that he's tested them, and he's going to have to be the one to answer that question. He says it works mainly as a pheromone, and all of them can be used as a potentized remedy and as a systemic spray. And I want to let those folks who are new to the show realize that when we talk about a systemic spray, we're not actually spraying it on the plant, but we're taking the remedy, diluting it in liters of water, and then applying it, like pouring it on the earth, so that the roots of each plant can soak it up. And he's saying that all companion plants work also as remedies. So he considers planting, when you plant two different types of plants together that love each other and harmonize in symbiotic relationship, when you do that, that is energy work. That is homeopathic. That is like cures like. they're enhancing each other. They go together like yin and yang. So when you talk about homeopathy is not simply a remedy off of a shelf. Homeopathy is a dynamic relationship. So a dynamic relationship between the symptoms that are going on with the living organism and the medicinal properties of that plant or animal or insect, whatever it is. How do they work together? And that is what we call homeopathic. It's just the dynamic relationship. So I hope that answers your question, Dr. Bob.
Yeah, and also Victor just sent a Wikipedia page that talks about
right.
homeodynamic agriculture, which is good.
Okay. So Kaviraj is telling us that many farmers cannot companion plant, and so they can use the remedies that are made from them on the monoculture. And the reason that so those folks who, you know, when we're talking about organic gardening and companion planting, it's very intensive work. It's for those home gardeners who have a small garden or a couple of acres, but you're not going to be able to do companion planting on multi-thousands of fields and fields of sunflowers and corn and all that. It's impossible because of the machinery and the technology that's used. In those cases, he's saying that in place of using the natural means of putting harmonizing with companion planting, you're using the potentization of those companion plants that work together.
That's exactly what I was getting at, is that if you're talking about someone who's farming on a commercial scale, the idea of having marigolds out there is terrific, other than the fact that they're not going to do it. Therefore, by potentizing the marigolds, if you could get a effect of
yes.
being able to keep certain pests away, that would be a tremendous organic way of being able to do integrated pest management without the chemicals.
Exactly. And that's what we would like to see. We would like to see the use of these homeopathic remedies and what happens in larger acreage. Because he says it will work, even though it's a monoculture. And, you know, monocultures are not good because we need to have diversity to keep a plant family strong. Like if something comes to wipe it out, we're going to lose it. So he's saying that it can take the place of the companion planting. And we have some more vegetables that he's giving us now, besides these herbs that we just spoke about. Beans. How do beans help our garden in the biodynamic way of helping the earth? All beans enrich the soil with the nitrogen fixing that it forms in the air. In general, they are good company or companions for carrots, celery, chard, corn, those are lots of C's, eggplant, peas, potatoes, brassicas, beets, radish, strawberry, and cucumbers. And that's really good to know. But I'm wondering, how does one plant, let's say, beans with strawberries? Because strawberries are very intensively grown, and they're one of the highest pesticide, the fruits with the highest amount of pesticide that you're supposed to be able to wash off, but I doubt you can.
It's number one in the United States.
Right. So how do we actually put together in our own personal garden the beans and the strawberries? Will the strawberries thrive around the bean plant?
What about double cropping in rows? I mean, basically, you're talking about row crops now. So you have a bed that has a row of strawberries in it. What's the preventing you in even a reasonably large size operation of having the next row being beans or whatever? That's not going to interrupt anything that you're doing. So
okay, we get
rows,
the go-ahead. We get the go-ahead from Kavi, yes.
Uh-huh.
we can do that. So that's very interesting. It's good to know that companion planting means that you can do in proximity, close just
right.
by rows.
Right.
Okay. And
very often, I mean, in tropical ecosystems where they have to use these techniques, they call that double and triple cropping, where in one field, in a row, you will have three different crops, not in the same row, but interspersed. One, you know, crop one in the first row, crop two in the second row, and crop three in the third.
Okay. So you're able to
grow the strawberries under the beans.
Excuse me?
That's interesting.
What?
Javi just wrote, grow the strawberries under the beans.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Beans are going to grow higher, and strawberries, of course, stay within 4 or 5 inches of the ground. That's possible.
That was my question, yes. Okay, so, but the strawberries would be kind of like a ground cover to keep the weeds down. And, you know, they have runners,
sure.
So they really would spread. Would they climb up the beans? I'm curious to know. So what are the three sisters? Strawberries, beans,
I don't know. Talking about three rows, maybe? I don't know.
I don't know. There's a third one, which I don't know what it is. Tell us, what are brassicas? Anybody? Okay, he's got the three. Beans, corn, and potatoes. Okay, so the beans are going to run up the corn, and the potatoes are going to be on the ground.
Yeah, brassicas are the mustard family, the cold crops like cabbage. Okay, those are brassicaceae.
Cabbage, and is that cucumber?
Okay, rutabaga, turnips, kohlrabi, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, and broccoli. Oh,
okay, there you go. Thank you.
Those are all brassicas.
Thank you. Okay, just for those who are uninitiated in the scientific world there. The beans give the shade to the strawberries, so that the leaves of the strawberries can be very tender and can get burnt from the sun, so the beans will be providing shade. And also the beans are – excuse me?
No, that sounds very plausible that you could do both together.
So the beans are very good for heavy nitrogen users like corn and grain plants. And that's why you plant them together. The French Haricot beans, the sweet corn, and the melons are a good combo. So it seems that there
are these triads
of vegetables.
Beans are legumes, therefore it's fixing nitrogen in the soil.
Yes.
So therefore you're adding nitrogen, and things like strawberries are very heavy nitrogen users. So it actually makes it a very compatible kind of crop. Plus, remember, it's very interesting. I never thought about this before. Virtually all strawberries are hand-picked.
Yes.
So if you add two layers, even in the same row, of the strawberries, which are basically right at ground level, that's where the berries will sit, okay, and the beans above it, it shouldn't be that much of a disturbance.
As a matter of fact, it would be good for the it would be good for the harvesters to get the shade from the corn.
Yep.
So Kaviraj is telling us about these triads, the beans, the corn, and the potatoes, which go together. They go together in stew, and they go together on the earth. And then we have corn, squash, and potatoes. I'm thinking of Thanksgiving already. Corn, squash, and potatoes make a good platter together. And that's Victor. And Victor says that the Native American grow them for thousands of years.
That's correct.
We need to learn from those people who lived on the land for so many years. We have the summer savory, which deters bean beetles and improves growth and flavor. But the summer savory, are not compatible with the alliums, which are the onions. So we need to learn where do we put our onions? What is compatible to grow with the alliums? Some people, like myself, would grow allium just for the beautiful flower, the little purple ball that looks like a star. It's just beautiful, and the smell is also fragrant. There are the, I don't know what the name of it is, but in my youth, there used to be some little, they're probably chives, that would just wild chives, and you would take them and chew them between your teeth and get the flavor of the onion. So what do we
have?
I have an
interesting observation here for onions.
Yes.
It says plant onions near or intermingled with cabbage, beets, strawberries, lettuce, and basically if you plant onions near potatoes, which
yes,
is a very interesting combination, that it is going to get rid of Colorado potato beetle, flies, and other insect pests.
And
having the allium
that's
next to the potatoes.
Yeah, and
so
it will
get your onions. You get your onions and potatoes together in one shot.
Good, and we just need sour cream, and we're good to go, or some
there
butter.
There you go.
That's great. You know, we can learn from nature if we just observe. So Kaviraj is telling us that beans, cucumbers, and corn is another triad, and that the allium, the onions, are a companion to carrots. So that's that.
Yep.
That's quite fascinating.
I see that
carrots,
same thing here.
The carrots are eating the root, and the allium, allium we're also eating the root, or like in scallions, if it's a baby tender plant, then we're getting the stem.
Kavi has a good observation. One of the biggest problems, I know whenever I try to grow carrots, you get root maggots.
Yes.
And by planting onions in between the carrots, it will deter any root maggots from attacking the carrots.
We've got to try it.
Yep.
And also, people, I know in Chinese recipes, you can eat the flowers of the tender allium. I mean, you could go with the whole plant there.
Allium is totally edible, yes.
And it is such a good pesticide. And what is another word that we could use for the fact that it helps with the fungicide?
Yeah, okay. Well, those are all pesticides. That's correct. I mean, basically, you got to remember that all of the alliums contain a number of different aromatic hydrocarbons. That's why they smell.
Yes.
They contain a lot of sulfur in it. That's a part of their natural composition. And hence, being a deterrent, particularly to any type of insect, maggots, flies, I'm reading here, it would work very well. And, of course, think about garlic, which is in the exact same family.
Absolutely.
As onion, okay, garlic sprays have been used for centuries to deter insects.
And they're so good for us as antibacterial, anti-germicide for us to eat. And good for our heart. So we're going to put that on our plate. Now we've got some bush beans, he tells us about, which are good to grow together with the Irish potato, the cucumber, corn, strawberry, celery, and I don't know whether you have the summer savory. Do you want to plant that with the summer savory, Kavi, the bush beans? It seems like you've got this selection of grouping that go really well together, and you want to select maybe two or three to put together and not go all out and do all of them. But find out what works. Find out where in your garden it's going to grow the best, whether the soil needs enhancing, some more compost, whether you've got to provide more water. There's a lot that needs to be thought about when you're laying out your garden and what you want to do, not just selecting your plants, but the lay of the land and the amount of sunlight, whether there's going to be any harsh wind coming, what side of the house it's planted on. These kinds of things you have to take into consideration. So Kaviraj tells us that the alliums can be used as pest repellents. And that's definite.
Yep.
We've got garlic improves growth and flavor. They also are highly, got a lot of sulfur in them. And they're beneficial to the beans, with one exception, the runner beans. Runner or pole beans and beets will stunt each other's growth. So make a note of that. And let's see how much we've got. A couple more minutes before the end of the show. We covered a lot of ground today of all of these companion plants. We've got a couple more. We can mention the bush beans and the pole beans, which are good with corn, summer savory, and radish, but are not good with the onions, radish, sunflower family, beets, and kohlrabi. The bee balm, which is a beautiful, beautiful plant, Oswego monarda, they come in a couple of different colors, whether you see them in purple or in red. They plant well with tomatoes to improve their growth and their flavor, and they are definitely good for attracting bees. And so there you've got your pollinators. They are a beautiful flower in your garden. They do well on banks near water, and they are a perennial. The only problem with them is they do get powdery mildew. And for some reason, I had tons of them in my garden. They seem to have disappeared, and I'm not sure whether my soil was just too dry, but they are not there anymore.
Yeah, bee balm has to have a lot of moisture. Usually they grow right along stream banks.
Yes, and I have a feeling that they also are how do you call it when they like to be in groups? You can't just plant one bee balm. You have to have a family of them together. They like to stay together in a group area. And then we have the beet. We have enough time to talk about the beet, which is good for adding minerals to the soil. The leaves are composed of 25% magnesium, making them a valuable addition to the compost pile if you don't care to eat them. And companions to the beet are lettuce, kohlrabi, onions, and the brassicas again. Garlic improves the growth and the flavor of the beet, I assume he means. And they are also beneficial to the beans, with the exception of the runner beans again. The runner or the pole beans and the beets will stunt each other's growth. So be sure to
keep
those.
I also have cabbage listed.
So I wonder whether beets will go good with the rue, because we have to keep the rue away from some of those other plants too. So I'm wondering how those would go together. And we, of course, know that the beets have a deep red color, and there are techniques for peeling them and cooking them so that the color doesn't dye and stain your countertops and your hands and everything. It's delicious as borscht, and obviously they must go very, very well with onions and garlic. So I think we're okay. So Kaviraj is telling us that the beets does not do well with the rue. Rue is a solitary plant. Oh, poor thing. I wonder if it's good for people who feel isolated. Very interesting. So we are at the end of the show. I want to thank you, Dr. Bob. I love you for calling in with me today. We're going to close the show and exit. Thanks to all the listeners. We had a really super show today, and see you next Wednesday with our gardening. Organic Gardening, How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens.
Adios.
Thank you for listening to How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens with co-hosts Kaviraj Vaikuthanath and Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to get some sunshine and light up your life in your garden.